Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for the podcast version of Trey's Variety Hour is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Welcome to the show, everybody. My name is Trey, and this is going to be a very special show, totally different than almost all of our others. It's going to be all beginning and intermediate question and answers for photography the entire time. We've got a ton of questions. We've got a lot of guests, all at various levels of beginner, all the way up to intermediate. And we'll just be doing all sorts of stuff. I don't even know what will come up. I think some bizarre things will probably happen. And we're also going to be showing a sneak preview of the new video course series that Karen and I are doing later this month. Is it that right, Karen?
Yes, it is, Trey. And I can't wait because I think people always think you only do HDR, but you're just a masterful teacher for beginners and intermediate people. And that's what you've done here. I think it's fantastic. I'm excited.
Well, thanks. It's going to be a lot of fun. I love teaching. I like doing this kind of stuff. And I think people are really going to get a kick out of all the work that we've done on this whole series, because it's really, really amazing. It's one of the best things I've ever put together. And we'll show lots of sneak previews of this today during the show, so people get to see a little bit more about it. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and introduce everybody as we go around. We'll start on the left and go to the right, because it's as arbitrary as any other direction. So we'll start with Andrea Warner over in the leftmost quadrant. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Trey. How are you?
Good. So anyway, during introductions, you can say who you are and where you're from and what you do or whatever.
Okay, so I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm an online marketer. I work with a really cool marketing community, and then I have my own little projects as well. And I've been a wannabe photographer for years, and I'm so excited that I might finally get past that initial hurdle of being an actual sort of photographer instead of just a wannabe.
Cool. Good to see you. And next is Anne Esperanto, who works at Google, although that's not the official capacity she's in today. She's here just sort of as a newbie photographer, and go ahead and say hello, Anne.
Yep. I'm Anne, and Trey is right. I'm actually glad that I am not the only wannabe photographer here, because that's kind of right below beginner photography. And I'm just here because I want to, you know, to up my skill level for a photographer. So definitely here to learn.
Cool. Great. Thanks, Anne. And next is Krista. Hello, Krista.
Hey, I'm Krista Laser. I'm an intellectual property and false advertising trial attorney at Kirkland & Ellis. I've got a cool book on goals at Flatbooks you can check out, and I'm just getting started with photography.
Cool. And we'll skip Dave. He's my wonderful producer.
Dave Vetter for the win.
Dave.com.
Karen, you didn't really introduce yourself. You just kind of assumed that everyone knew who you were. But
well, you know, I don't want to get all glowy or anything. Hi, I'm Karen Hutton, and I do voiceovers professionally at KarenHutton.com. I do photography as well at KarenHuttonPhotography.com. Home is here on Google+, and I have a pet project I'm really proud of. It is growing slowly, but it's going to be fantastic, called Lil Galleries at lilgalleries.com. That's L-I-L galleries.com. A real community effort. Everybody there is from Google+, and we're really proud of it.
Excellent. Thank you, Karen. Mm-hmm. And next is Keith. Hello, Keith.
Hi, Trey. I'm Keith Barrett. I'm an IT and software developer over at the Walt Disney Company and founder of vidcastnetwork.com, where I live stream and record a lot of Google+ Hangouts and other things. And an amateur photographer just starting out. I've only had a camera for about 90 days right now, so looking forward to this.
Great. And next is Sly Vegas. Hello, Sly.
Hi, guys. I'm Sly Vegas. I'm a San Francisco Bay Area-based amateur wedding and event photographer. And I'm also here to learn lots of awesome stuff. I caught Trey's tutorial early on when I first picked up the camera, and I'm real excited that he's taking it back to the fundamentals. I think it's real important. I'm excited to be a part of the show.
Great. Well, thank you. And last over there is Tony. Hey, Tony, how are you?
I'm good. I'm Tony, and I'm an editor and producer at Twit, and also, I guess, an amateur photographer. So,
cool. Good to see you, Tony. So I'm here in Queenstown. I'll show everybody a picture that I took this morning. Let me go share my screen over here so you can see what it looked like off my balcony. So I took this, you know, it's different over here. It's early morning.
Wow.
And this is just off my balcony just a few hours ago. And it is just gorgeous here. And I thought, you know, since I went ahead and took this photo this morning, I saved all the files that I used to make it and everything. And I'll probably do this one, you know, live during the real class towards the end of the term. We have four different classes for this thing. And probably on the last day, I'll show how I did this one because it came out kind of nice. Queenstown is really beautiful. It's kind of easy to take photos here in a way. So before we start showing a little preview of this thing and get to the questions and answers. Oh, by the way, okay, here's the whole plan for today. By the way, today's show is just really a thinly veiled infomercial. For this new video series, okay? It's really awesome video series, but as opposed to most infomercials, this will be very useful because we're going to spend the whole time doing Q&A and answering questions. There should be some real tangible, practical things in here for you. We're going to show a little, like, two-minute snippet of it, and then we'll go ask questions. Everyone has different questions that we'll go through. And then we'll show an extended snippet where I'm actually out in the field taking photos. And then I bring those photos into Lightroom, and you'll see how I move all the sliders around. That'll come maybe in about 20 or 30 minutes into the show from now. Okay, so that's a little idea of what's coming. So, Dave, you have a little snippet you can run for us right now that gives a little bit of indication as to what happens in the first of these four things.
Hello, my name is Trey Ratcliffe. My photography has taken me all around the world, and I've been able to discover all kinds of cool things, not just about the world, but about the whole craft of creating art. Here is an Nikon, a little Fuji. Here is a Canon. I'm going to help you take your first few steps along your very own path to creating your own kind of art. And we'll do this by talking about photography in sort of a new way. I got started with photography about 5 years ago, and I made many mistakes along the way, but I also figured out a lot of stuff. I started making tutorials several years ago, and most of these tutorials have been of an intermediate to advanced nature. And I realized that a lot of the questions I end up getting are sort of beginner in nature. And a lot of these questions help remind me of some of the fundamentals of being a photographer. And it's a big reason I'm making these videos now, because it's these fundamental concepts of curiosity and discovery that kind of drive the artist forward. And as I continue to talk with beginners and answer questions, it helps me to reanalyze the foundations of photography, because things are always changing. There's always new technology, there's always new hardware, there's always new software. And by talking with beginners or people that are just getting started, it helps me reanalyze these foundational principles that keep me moving forward through the art. So one of the fundamental misconceptions about photography is that you need to know everything about your camera before you go out and shoot. These things are very scary. They've got all these buttons and gizmos and dials and menu systems, and they're incredibly complex. And I understand how it can be very frustrating or off-putting, and you don't even want to go out and take photos because you don't feel like you're doing it right. You don't feel one with your camera. But don't worry about any of that nonsense. There's only a few things you need to know about the camera before you go out and start shooting.
Good. Okay. Thanks, Dave. So I'll say one more thing about this before we get into our Q&A period. If you want to find out more, go to stuckincustoms.com/art of photography, and you'll see what's in all four classes. It starts at the very end of this month, and it'll be a lot of fun. This is sponsored by HDRsoft. Those are the guys that make Photomatics, which you guys know is the HDR tool that I use in my workflow. It's also sponsored by Adorama and Smug Mug and Nick. And we've got two ways to register for the full thing. If you do the Bring a Friend, which is a great deal, it saves a ton of money, but you also get a chance to win not one, but two free cameras. You get to have your choice of a Sony NEX7, a Nikon D7000, or a Canon 60D. So you can get one for you and one for the friend you bring along. They'll probably thank you for the rest of their lives. So it's a great deal. We've got tons of other prizes and all kinds of stuff. Everything is there on the website for you to see. Okay, so let's get started with questions. We've got so many to get to. Let's start with you, Karen. You have one for me?
I do. I'm in a quandary. Do you want to hear one about the program itself or a specific camera question?
Give me a specific camera question.
Okay, if you're shooting RAW, and we all know there's so much information in a RAW photo versus a JPEG, is it better to err, and you know, you can get so much info out of it in Lightroom, is it better to err on the side of a too light photo or a too dark photo? And the second part of that is, what the heck do I do with white balancing?
Ah, okay. So with RAW, yes, you should always be shooting in RAW, not JPEG. But if you have an option of not nailing it right, if you want to go over or under, it's best to go over, because you can always dial it down quite a bit in Lightroom to fix these blown out areas. In fact, there's this one photo I took of the space shuttle going up into the clouds. I did that with it was actually a poorly executed shot in some ways, because I dramatically overexposed it by like three stops. In fact, I looked at it, I thought, oh, it's way too blown out, way too bright. But then I got into Lightroom, I was able to dial it back down and get all the details back. And so anyway, going too bright is always safer. As far as white balance is concerned, you don't really have to concern yourself with white balance if you're in RAW mode, because you can always change the white balance later in post-processing. Anyway, so there's that answer.
Very good.
Okay, so let's move left to right, because I know everyone has questions. Andrea, give me a good question.
Okay, this is something that I really struggle with. I need to know what a good mom lens is, because I've got my camera, I'm running around with the kids and stuff, and I'm like, I can't just be like, okay, guys, stop, I got to change lenses before I can take that picture. What's a good kind of versatile all-around lens that is good for a mom?
Yes, well, there's really two lenses any mom should need. And I know that's not exactly the answer you wanted, because you don't want to have to be swapping lenses all the time. But really, frankly, if you have sort of an entry-level camera, it probably comes with something called a kit lens, which might be like, 28 to 85, for example. Every camera's different. And that is both wide angle and a little bit of zoom. And that'll give you a certain amount of flexibility that you can take a lot of daytime shots without any real issues. Where you will run into issues with that beginner kit lens is in darker situations, where the lens isn't quite fast enough to be able to get the light that's kind of low in that room. So you have a few options. One, you can upgrade to a better lens. There is one that's kind of expensive. There's a Nikon and a Canon. It's a 28-70 2.8 lens. And these are actually quite expensive lenses, but it's flexible enough for almost all kit situations. And it's fast enough where you won't need a flash indoors. You can just do wide angle or zoom in. It could be nice and quick. The other lens that I would recommend if you're a mom is a 50 millimeter prime lens. There's a 1.8 option. And I have recommendations on my website of all these lenses and stuff. But this 1.8 option is only like $100 or $200. And it won't zoom at all, but you'll be able to get very crisp, clean shots of your kids with that nice kind of out-of-focus background. This is one of these cameras, right, that makes your kids look like they are always having professional photos taken of them. Even if you're just like just getting started with photography and you don't even really know what you're doing, if you have this lens, occasionally you'll make these very professional-looking photos of your kids, and you'll be really impressed, and your Facebook friends will be blown away if you keep posting this stuff. So anyway, those are two good lenses to get started.
Cool. Thanks.
Sure. Okay, Anne, I'm ready.
Great. So as I mentioned, I'm just a wannabe photographer, and I have a Canon S100, which is not really a DSLR because I don't think I'm ready yet for a DSLR. And I find that I'm relying too heavily on my default settings. So if, say, I want to go a bit more advanced, what are like the most important manual settings that I should know about at an absolute basic level? And how do I set those up very quickly so that I'm not missing moments like the sunset or like my dog running or like my nephew playing in the park?
Sure. Well, you don't have to jump right from automatic to manual. That's sort of a cataclysmic chasm you have to fall. You have to jump over to get into manual. That's a little scary. You can go into aperture priority mode, and that's actually where I shoot most of the time. That's where a lot of photographers shoot most of the time. That way you can make a few decisions on your own and let the camera make the rest of the decisions. And actually, coming up in this next little snippet that we'll show in about 20 minutes, I show how the camera gets into aperture priority mode. I shoot in aperture priority mode, and then you can do all the post-processing later without really having to worry about if you made it okay with manual or not. There's too many decisions, frankly, for beginners to have to make if you switch into manual. And I think that's actually a disservice that a lot of photography courses or teachers do, is they immediately make the people get into manual mode and learn all of these moving levers and memorize these actuarial tables. It's just ridiculous. So anyway, that's a long way of saying aperture priority mode, and you're about to see a little sneak preview of that. Okay. Krista.
All right. So I've watched some of your other shows before, and you talk sometimes about using a small aperture and a slow shutter speed to get some cool silky water effects. What other tips do you have for getting cool effects using some of these manual options?
Yes, you look so bright, by the way, Krista. You're just
Sorry,
like blown out.
Happens, the white screen.
Yeah. You almost look like a 2D paper doll there.
Hey, you were the one who said it's better to be overexposed, right?
Yeah, see?
She learned it already.
No, I was talking about being overexposed on social media, not... No. Why are you laughing so much, Karen Hutton?
Because you okay. are funny, I got to tell you.
What was the question? Oh, yeah, silky water. So, yes, this is one of these... In fact, I remember when I was first getting into photography, this was a picture I always wanted, right? I always wanted a nice bubbling brook or a waterfall with a nice silky strands. I thought, oh, you know, that's the kind of photo that means you're like a real photographer when you've got silky water. So I was very interested in this whole thing. Let's say that you want to take a picture of a waterfall or moving water, and you do want these silky strands, and it's the middle of the day. Well, there's a lot of, you know, hardcore kind of gearheads, camera guys, that will insist that you have to have like an ND filter, which is a very dark plane of glass that you put in front of your camera that makes it so dark that you have to keep your shutter open for a long time so that everything appears silky. But you don't really have to do that. excuse me. What you can do is... you crank up your f-stop as high as it'll go, like f22 or f38, or it depends on your lens. And then if you're in aperture priority mode and you have your ISO set very low, then your shutter will stay open for a long time, long enough to get silky strands. It doesn't have to be open for like 30 seconds. It can just be open for a few seconds and you'll get those silky strands. So that way you can kind of get that nice silky effect without having to put these extra filters in front. Okay, so aperture priority mode, very high f-stop, and a tripod, of course. That kind of goes without saying, I hope. And does that help a little, Krista?
Well, I don't know. Are there any other tips besides the silky water that you can get from those kind of manual options?
Oh, you mean by changing around your aperture?
Yeah, like what funky effects can you get?
Well, you know, if you have, there's so much that goes into aperture. You can do a million different effects with your aperture. You know, if you have a, like for example, in the case of a 50 prime, if you set the aperture very, very low, to like 1.8, for example, then you can get that effect where one thing is in focus and other things are out of focus. If you have a really extreme zoom lens, like sometimes you see people on the side of football games, or you see wildlife photographers, these huge giant lenses. Well, if they want just one thing in focus, they can get that to work as well by fully zooming in and then setting their f-stop at like f4, for example. And then they can have a deer or a moose kind of pop off the background. But if they wanted everything to be in focus, like the distant mountain, then they would increase their f-stop really, really high. So what happens as you start to learn aperture priority, which isn't too hard, that's actually what we go through in the first lesson, is that as soon as you sit down with a situation, it's nice to have choices. Because then you can say like, oh, okay, you know, do I want my child to be in focus and then everything else to be out of focus? Or do I want the child and the balloons to be in focus and everything else to be out of focus? Or do I want everybody at the party to be in focus? And then you can start to play with your settings and make that work. So really, once you start understanding this major moving lever of aperture, it gives you a ton of choices for your photos. So let's go with, Karen, you already asked one. Let's go with you, Keith.
Hi, Karen already asked this a little bit, from somebody else that, she was reading the question for. My camera, we're talking about the, RAW setting, which I totally get. My camera's got a RAW plus JPEG setting, which means I can shoot both types of photos at the same time, which I found useful for photos I don't intend to post process. I'm going to post quickly to social media or share with friends. And of course, the trade-off is the shutter speed is going to be slowed down a little bit. I'm worried that is this a good thing, or am I developing a bad habit, or should I just not do that? Because, you know, RAW photos you have to process. You can't post them to the network easily.
Yes, that's true. But if I were you, and I know there's some people out there that do RAW plus JPEG all the time. To me, it creates unnecessary file management. Because, you know, what you're doing is you get home from a shoot, right? And then you dump all your photos onto your computer. So they're all sitting there. And if you do RAW plus JPEG, you kind of have a duplicate of each one. And yes, the JPEG is able to quickly be uploaded to social media stuff. But really, frankly, if you're using Lightroom to organize your photos, then it's so easy just to quickly make adjustments and then export it as a JPEG. It takes just about as much time as sending it to social media or whatever anyway. It's just very, very quick. So I say just stay RAW. Maybe you might want to make a few presets inside Lightroom that do some of your basic adjustments that you always do. Maybe that you increase the clarity a little bit, or you drop the highlights a little bit, and just save it as a preset. And then you can go select all of your photos and just run this preset, and then they're all going to look way better than the JPEGs anyway. So it hardly takes any more time, and you're going to have a much better photo. and you won't have all the file management woes that just come with just looking at two of everything and keeping it straight in your mind. It's just something else to worry about. So I say just stay with RAW.
Okay.
All right. So let's, Karen, we have questions that are coming in from all over the place.
Yes, we do. We have some from the blog. Would you like to hear one?
Yes.
Do you want names? Because that's like a trick question.
Yes, give us names.
Thanks. This is from, and you know, apologies in advance to everyone at brutalizing your names if I do. This is from Sashi Kanth Chintla, who asks, Trey, I have enrolled in your class and I'm looking forward to it. My question is how to increase the sharpness in the camera. My pictures look a little soft. I'm using a D700 with a 14 to 24 and a 24 to 70 millimeter 2.8. And I think maybe Zachary Cox from Google Plus also asked that question.
Yes. So you have two really good lenses there. Really, you can't get any sharper than those two lenses you have. He said he had the 14 to 24 and the 28 to 70.
24 to 70, 2.8.
24 to 70, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is often a question about sharpness that people are very concerned about. There's many ways to skin the sharpness cat. One of them is to when post-process, okay? This is often what I do. And there's two stages at which you can sharpen. One is in Lightroom. If you're using Lightroom 4, the new one, there's this clarity slider, which is different and evolved since Lightroom 3. That can really make stuff extremely sharp, almost too sharp in a way. So that's one way to do it. Another way is later in Photoshop. You don't have to go into Photoshop, but if you do, there's a plugin that I like to use called Topaz Adjust, and that can sharpen. But here's a little trick, and this is not really necessarily in Lightroom or in Photoshop. It's more just sort of an approach. Find like something in your photo that is the most interesting, okay? The tree or a cat or whatever, I don't know. Take that thing and make that sharp. You know, use clarity or use a plugin to make that quite sharp. And then have everything else not be blurry, but just sort of regular, right? With the kind of unsharpness that you're used to. Because if everything is equally sharp, it's hard to tell what's sharp and what's not. It's good to have a few parts of your photo that really pop, and everything else is not blurry, but just kind of less sharp. And then your eye will start to catch on to lines, because that's what the human eye does, is when it scans a photo or any scene, is it will catch on to lines of contrast where light meets dark, and it will kind of, you know, surf around inside that sharp area. And then it will drift across the more blurry area to another sharp area. So really, that's the best way to increase your sharpness, is by varying the degrees of sharpness throughout your photo.
Okay. And of course, if you have a 2.8 and you're using it down there, focusing on just the right spot also helps.
Yes, that's true. Yep. That's true. You know, actually, I don't even use my 2.8 that much anymore, Karen. I have I have a 24 to 70 2.8 and a 70 to 200 2.8. And I do like to take people photos and this sort of thing. But as far as landscapes are concerned, I'm able to get just fine sharpness with my 28 to 300, which does not have as low of an f-stop. And I know some landscape photographers disagree with me on sharpness and all that, but I find my stuff is perfectly sharp whenever I want it to be. Okay, so Dave, let's take this other bit of the sneak preview. This one's a little longer. So in this one, what you'll see me doing is you'll see me kind of setting up one of the cameras. I talk about how to set up several different cameras. And then I go out in Austin to take photos like of a tree. And then I go home, and in Lightroom, I show how I mess with some of these adjustments for this tree. But before you show that, I'm going to throw you a curveball, Dave. Sorry, I didn't say I was going to do this. Let me go share my screen here. Speaking of trees, these are three photos of trees that I took here in the last few weeks in Queenstown. Actually, this is in Wanaka. And one reason I'm going to show these three trees is because what you're about to see in Lightroom is very kind of beginner type stuff. But as we move through the beginner stuff in the first, you know, two and three classes, in the fourth one, we'll get a little bit more complex and start moving into some intermediate and even some HDR type stuff. And so this tree, which I haven't released this photo yet, this is another tree from that same lake. And then this one, which you might remember, I posted this a few weeks ago. These three trees, let me zoom in here, this part. I think I quite like this part. So it's quite a big file. So these three trees, I'm going to fully post-process at the end of lesson four. And again, the reason I say that is because, let me unscreen share, is because this part you're about to see is beginnerish, right? We do spend an ample amount of time on beginner stuff. But I've been seeing a lot of questions like, oh, you know, we want to see how you do more post-processing. We want to see how you do layers. We want to see how you do some of your more advanced HDR stuff. And so anyway, we get to all that in lesson four. Okay, so anyway, roll that tape, Dave.
Aperture by turning this front dial, okay? It's easier to look right here if I press the info button. You can see right now we are at F4. That's how you measure aperture. It's the F number. And as I move this around, you'll see it goes all the way up to F25, all right, and all the way down to F4. This changes based on the lens. The smaller the number, the more light that gets in. The bigger the number, the less light that gets in. Well, what does all that mean? I'll show you when we're out in the field. Just remember that by changing this number, you can change the kind of photo that you're taking. And it's better to show you examples than talk theoretically about it. We'll get to that soon. Okay, so now I will show you how to set it up in RAW mode, okay? So we look at this thing, right? This is a mess. I don't know who designed this, not Apple. But anyway, don't worry about that. We're just going to look at this one little area down here. What I'll do is I will change the quality level from JPEG to RAW. Okay. As I hold down the quality button and I slide this dial, you'll see that it changes from one mode to the next. I want to keep going until I get just to RAW, which you can see right there. Now it's set up and ready to go. Here we have a Canon. Okay. This operates pretty much just like the Nikon, except it's got its own picadillos. It probably came in the auto mode, so we're going to switch it over to AV.
Now that we have your new camera set up, we're ready to take a shot. We'll start with a landscape shot. I think landscapes are always fun to get started with because you can be patient. You don't have to worry about hurting the landscape. You can take your time. You can fiddle with your camera. You get in position. It's easier than starting with people because the other people are always expecting you to do something or be somewhere or act a certain way. But, you know, so much of starting with photography is just wrestling with your own incompetence that it's best to wrestle with your own incompetence in the solitude of nature where no one can be there while you're embarrassed. So anyway, here we are communing with nature, and we're here at a beautiful spot here in Austin. And I've got the camera all set up like we did before. I'm going to set it at F8. Remember, we can control the aperture now. And if we put it in F8, that's always safe, okay? If you're in F8, chances are that everything will be in focus, all right? So when in doubt, just go with F8, all right? So now the only challenge is finding a good composition, which is pretty easy out here. There's many good things to see. There's a beautiful tree. There's a cool bridge. There's clouds. The sun will be setting soon. There's water. There's boats. Everything's out here. So we'll probably be able to create several different photos while we're out here. I'll start just by taking a photo of the bridge and the clouds and the golf course and maybe downtown Austin beyond it. Okay, so there's this cool tree here. And even when I'm zoomed all the way out at 18 millimeter, I can't quite get the tree in. So I need to back my human person up further so that I can get it in. I hope I don't back over a cliff. Otherwise, this tutorial will be drastically short. There, that fit just fine.
Now that you've had a little quick tour of Lightroom, let's use it to work on a photo that we just took when we were outside by the tree. This is a great one to work on because, well, you'll see. I'll save a surprise for you. Let's get started by looking at some of the metadata. This is some of the data about the photo itself. So if we look up here, we'll see that it was shot at 18 millimeter. You may remember that we were using the kit lens and we had it as wide as possible setting, which is 18 millimeters. You might also remember that I set the camera at f8, right? That's always a safe setting if you want to make sure everything's in focus. There is also the ISO here, and the ISO was automatically selected by the camera at 6400. That's quite a high number, so we're going to have some noise with this photo. I'll show you what noise is, and I'll show you how we can get rid of it very easily in Lightroom. And the last thing to look at is this is the shutter speed, 1/4,000th of a second, which is quite fast. That's how long the shutter was open, letting in light. You could just look at this in interest if you want to. You don't really have to understand it. One thing you might like to know is that this shutter speed was automatically chosen by the camera because we're in aperture priority mode. When you're in that mode, the computer inside, which is very, very smart, it will choose how fast the shutter should be. And actually, this is often why I keep it in aperture priority mode, because to me, the camera is so smart. You know, let it choose the exposure. It's often quite perfect. Okay, so let's start editing this photo. Oftentimes, I like to start with cropping. Okay, you can see the edge of my tripod in there. That was a little sloppy, wasn't it? A little bit bush league. So let's get rid of that. I'm just going to crop in here on the side a little bit. I'll crop in on the other side, so the tree's kind of in the middle. I'll crop up to get rid of some of the lower area because it's a little dull maybe. Then I'll bring this down to maybe right here. It'll be sort of still a tall photo. Then I'll hit enter. Okay. Now, let's scroll this up to the top because remember this is the basic panel. There's a lot of power right here. And if I just grab this exposure slider and start bringing it down, you'll see all the amazing detail that's in those clouds. Look at that. Now, we're not going to keep it down this low, but this is a good example of why a RAW file is so powerful, because it captured all this light that's really there. And it's really quite remarkable that it picked all this up. So we're going to bring this up a little bit, not quite so dramatic, okay? We're going to take these highlights down a little bit. Okay, this is the bright area that we're reducing. Let's increase the shadows quite a bit. Okay, that brings out more of the tree trunk and more of the ground and the distant green mountains. Let's drop down the whites and increase the blacks. Let's amp up the clarity. Okay. And let's amp up the vibrance a little bit. All right. Let's also go ahead and bring in a little bit of vignetting, okay, to give it a little bit of attitude. Cool. So everything looks great with this photo so far. One thing you may not notice is the noise. The noise is actually quite bad. So if I zoom in right here, you can see all these little speckles. All these little speckles are noise. It's kind of sandpapery and whatnot. Now, remember, if you share the photo kind of zoomed out like this on the web, most people would never even notice the noise. And oftentimes, the only people that complain are the noise police. You know, they'll come leave a comment on your photo saying, I see a little noise in the lower left-hand quadrant. You can ignore those people. You have my permission. However, you may be kind of a stickler for noise yourself, and you want to get rid of the noise. Maybe you want to make a big print, which is fine, and you don't want to have any noise in the print. Anyway, it's not a problem. It's quite easy to get rid of the noise. I'll show you how to do it. The way to do it is down here in the detail panel, okay? So I'll open this thing up here. And we've got this magical area here called the noise reduction area. It also will go ahead and zoom in for you, right? And so you can kind of see what's going to happen.
Okay. There you go. A little sneaky sneak there for you. Enjoyed that bit. So let's get back into questions. We'll go left to right. First, let's pull in one from one of the streams that's incoming, Karen. Karen. My ace in the hole.
Must have been some question.
Yeah. She's never around when I need her. She's like the police.
I have a question. Did you tape that today, Trey?
Did I tape that today? Oh.
Same shirt.
You were wearing the same shirt.
Oh. Was I? Oh yeah. Oh, look at that. I am wearing the same shirt. Only a girl would notice that. Nope. No guy noticed that I was in the same shirt.
No, I didn't. Although I was wondering, and the chat room asked this too, what's the program you're using to make the mouse do the circles and blow up?
Okay. But right before I answer that question, I want the girls will be happy to know that I've actually washed my shirt in between wearings.
I was worried.
I thought that was going to be the prize, like the unlaundered shirt of Trey Ratcliffe.
Yeah. Right. It's better if it's a little bit used, like Britney Spears' pregnancy test.
Okay, it's a good shirt. It's fine if it's your favorite shirt or your lucky shirt.
No, it's just a shirt. Just a shirt. So that program that I use is great. It's called ScreenFlow Pro. And, you know, you can zoom in and all those little effects I was doing. It's really fun. And actually, I do that stuff myself because I know what I want to zoom in on and focus on and that sort of thing. So ScreenFlow Pro is great. It's only for the Mac, though. I'm a Mac. I'm unapologetically a Mac kind of guy. I used to dislike Macs, and I really disliked Mac people, but now I'm a total convert. It shows how open-minded I am.
It's about time.
Yes, it's about time. Okay, Karen, you're back.
I'm back. That was fun.
I didn't try to waste time while you were gone, but this is what I do.
So. Did you tap dance? Because that's always a good time killer.
I was going to wait for Andrea to put on a little soft shoe in the corner.
You want me to ask that question again?
I never heard it, so yes.
Oh, really? Oh, I dropped out before that. Okay, yeah. So here we go. Drum roll, please. Dieter Armugam from Google+. Asks you this question. Not sure if this is the right post to ask the questions for later, but would you ever recommend Tamron or Sigma lenses for people starting out on a tight budget, or is it always better to go for Nikon, Canon, etc. proprietary lenses? Thank you.
Yes, good question, Dieter. I absolutely recommend the cheaper lenses if you're on a budget. There's not that big of a difference between some of the cheaper lenses and some of the more expensive lenses. In fact, there is this wide-angle lens. This is something I recommend to everybody that's just getting started that doesn't have much money. Once you have a wide-angle lens, you never go back. And so there's this Sigma 10 to 20 millimeter lens that is a portion of the price of its Nikon and Canon counterparts. And man, it is great, great lens. So yeah, there's no shame at all in getting a non-Nikon or non-Canon lens. There's some photographers that might, you know, look down their nose at you, but just ignore those people there. It says more about them than it does about you. So just, you know, go get your whatever lens you want and have fun with it.
So many people to ignore. That's what I love about this whole trade.
Yeah.
Vast flocks of people we can just ignore.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is that, you know, photography used to be just for the elite few. And now anyone can do this, you know, like these tricks or whatever that I'm showing you, anybody can do this stuff. It's very, very fun. And, you know, it used to be this elite group of photographers that would not tell you how to do anything. It's a very kind of old boys club, almost like Scientology in a way. And so anyway, but now there's actually so many photographers out there that you could just choose to willfully ignore a giant section of them. And there's still, you know, millions of people that are in your court of thought. So it's a very cool thing about photography.
And a lot of people swear by Sigma. I mean, Tamron too, yeah. But I see it all the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of Sigma lovers out there for sure. Mm-hmm. I do have a bad, I shouldn't say anything bad about Tamron. Just about, they had a bad PR person that contacted me and was trying to get me to do something. Of course I said no, but I could tell if they contacted me to do something which I thought was unethical, they probably contacted hundreds of other bloggers to do that kind of stuff. So I thought that was kind of lousy. That kind of sticks in my craw a little bit, Tamron. So anyway.
We can ignore them.
Yeah.
And stick with
our
theme.
Their lenses are fine. Their PR team might need a little work.
Yeah, we'll ignore them. We'll stick with the lenses and ignore the rest of the guy.
Yeah. I want that as a T-shirt. Trey says I can ignore you.
Yeah. All right, Stu, ignore that person. Okay, let's go left to right again. Andrea, give me your next question.
Okay, so you'd never know this to look at me, but I love black. I love to wear it. I like it in my house. I really like black. And recently I tried to help my friend take some photos of some really cool pieces of antique jewelry. And we were using a black backdrop, and I couldn't get the photos to work that way. We had to do it a different way. So what suggestions do you have for using a black backdrop?
Ah, well, for shooting jewelry in particular, let me answer that question because that seems to be more practical. Or anything that's small where you want to have a black background. It takes a little bit of setup, you know, but these are the kind of photos that will get shared more on Pinterest than the other one. Not that you're on Pinterest or anything, Andrea.
No, not at all. No. Yes, I am.
So what happens is if you put something right on a black background, like black felt, and you take a photo of it, it can look okay, but sometimes it just kind of is a little literal, isn't it? A little obvious. But
well, they were grainy too.
Grainy. Ah, well, that's a different issue. Okay, I'll solve both of those issues at once.
Awesome. Solve all my problems. Thank you.
One is the grainy problem. Okay. So you can have a black background, but kind of have it on the floor, right? And then have a layer of glass that's raised up. Okay, and then put the jewelry on the glass. And then try to have light coming in underneath it. Okay, that will light it up at the bottom and make it look very luminescent and glowy and ethereal.
Oh, cool.
Jewelry-like.
Cool, thanks for that.
That will look a lot better. To get rid of the graininess is probably because of the noise. And you can get rid of the noise by keeping the camera very, very still and setting your ISO as low as possible.
Okay.
If you set your ISO like to 100, for example, you will get zero grain. But you'll have to make sure you keep the camera still so that it doesn't move around. It's going to want to keep the shutter open a long time, especially if it's a more inexpensive camera. The shutter will stay open a long time so that you collect enough light so that it doesn't have to guess at the light with the noise. That's what noise is, by the way. Noise is the camera guessing at the light because the shutter wasn't open long enough to get enough light.
Oh, good. Very interesting. Thank you. Very helpful. I'll stick with my black.
Okay. Go on, Anne. You're next.
Sure. So I just actually came back from Sedona, Arizona, in the Grand Canyon, which is, have you ever been there, Trey? Have you taken photos there?
Yes. Did you go to, what are those things? They're called vortexes, those spiritual vortexes. Did you go on any of those?
No, we stayed within the canyons.
It's very New Agey. There's these New Agey people there. There's like these spots that you go to, and they're like these temporal vortexes. And you go into them, and you're able to tap into the unearthly, ethereal feelings of humankind that cycle through these magical New Age spaces.
Have you done that?
No. I'm not really into that, but I think it's interesting.
Did they give you something to ingest before you went in there?
Well, I'm sure they, I think they sell mushrooms at every convenience store in Sedona.
Anyway, so I just came back there from there for 4th of July, and I actually really enjoy taking photos because it's really beautiful there. But I'm sort of finding that the camera on my phone is taking better photos than my Canon S100, meaning my photos are looking more bolder in color, like the colors in the photos are looking bolder and just it pops out more. Why is that? And on a related question, as smartphones get smarter, I find it really, really annoying to actually take both my camera and my phone with me. So what are like the different scenarios that would be better for you to take your camera versus your smartphone?
Yes, that's a good question because there are a lot of people getting into photography and they might get a small camera. And they're like, I don't feel like it's that much better than what my camera phone can take. Especially if I've started to use apps like Instagram or something to make your camera phone photos even better. Well, what's probably happening with your camera versus your cell phone is that your mobile phone camera will just take a JPEG, and built in to all of these cell phone cameras is something that makes your JPEG automatically look better, right? It will increase the contrast, it will increase saturation, it will increase the sharpness. So immediately your cell phone photo may look pretty dang sharp next to what comes out of your camera, especially if you're shooting in RAW mode, because what comes out of your camera in RAW mode is quite flat, right? It's quite flatly lit. There's not a lot of contrast. There's not a lot of saturation. There's not a lot of sharpness. It's just sort of blah. But that is the very nature of a RAW file. It's purposely like that. You are expected to, bring that into your computer and then do just a little bit of post-processing on it. Like you saw in that video how I was moving around those sliders. If you just spend, 30 seconds moving around these sliders, you can make your camera photo look 10 times as good as your cell phone photo. And it's sort of an attitudinal thing involved here in that you have to want to get your camera and dump it onto your computer and then move sliders around. But once this becomes part of your life, right, which it can easily become part of your life. I mean, 5 years ago, none of us were 10 years ago, we weren't thinking about going on Facebook and doing a status update or going on Google Plus and posting a photo. Now you think about this stuff quite a bit. That has kind of like become part of your digital life. And so if you're just getting into cameras, maybe part of your digital life hasn't been dumping those pictures off onto your computer and moving around sliders, but it should be, because just by moving around a few of these little sliders, your camera photos will come out looking way better than your cell phone photos. And as for part B of your multi-headed hydra of a question, I would still carry around two things, right? Because the camera phone will always be good for sort of quick and dirty shots. But as you become more and more proficient and conversant with your DSLR or even your more consumer camera, you'll just get better results out of that. And since, you always think, right, when you're in Sedona, you always think, oh, this is really pretty. I'll, I'll come back here someday, but you might not. You know, I think we kind of lie to ourselves sometimes, don't we? When, like even me, I go to a place and think, oh, this is really nice. I'll come back here someday and I'll have a better camera. But I might not really. So you might as well get the best photo you can with the best equipment while you're there, just in case you don't come back. So anyway, just take both with you.
And I did say I was going to come back.
Oh, okay. Well, good. You probably meant it.
Trey?
Yes?
I have a question within a question, which is, can we hear a question from Sly? Because I was looking for my crystal ball, because after you talking about vortexes, I'm hearing this voice going, Sly has a question. And I think it's coming from my crystal ball, but I can't find it. So,
yes, I will allow it.
Oh, wow. Great and powerful Radcliffe has spoken.
Thank you for your graces, Sir Radcliffe. So I have a question. There's this unusual thing that is present on all of our cameras, well, most of our cameras, and I honestly first discovered it when I saw your tutorial, your HDR tutorial. And it sounds a lot like a surgical procedure and looks almost equally intimidating. So my question is, Trey, what is a histogram?
Ah, a histogram.
Yes.
That's very scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to know what a histogram is in order to take a good photo, okay? Most of the time, let's say you take a photo and then you look at a preview of the photo on the back. If it looks good, then you're probably just fine, okay? It's nothing to worry about. But sometimes, you know, you might take a photo, then you look at the back and you see like it's really white and really blown out, or it's super duper dark. And then you know that there is a problem. There's something going on, that your settings weren't quite right. So what a histogram is it, if you don't know what we're talking about, it's sort of, it looks like this mathematical thing. It's a rectangle. And then there's all these little lines that bounce up and down it. And they're either moved over to the left or moved over to the right, or there's some sort of strange, you know, like Stairmaster random program on there, right? You don't have to worry about any of that, really. One thing you might notice, though, is that if you look at the histogram, and if all the little lines are pushed up against one side or the other, that means that you're losing some of the light data. But you probably knew that anyway. If the photo was really, really dark, if it was really, really dark, you'll probably notice that all those little Stairmaster randomizer lines are crowded up against the left side, which is the dark side. Or if it's really blown out, all those little lines might be crowded over to the right side, which is the bright side. Basically, every picture is a collection of light, and that histogram is just another way, a quite nerdy way, frankly, of looking at that light. For all practical purposes, you can just look at the preview of the photo without having to look at this mathematical data extrapolation version of it. There you go. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, Krista, ask away.
All right. Yeah, so I have a question about composition. And a lot of the photos look really cool. You've got these pathways heading into the horizon and things like that. Is that to draw the eye inwards? And what other tips do you have for where the eye should be falling? Do you keep an eye out for that?
You're muted or something, Trey.
I'm sorry, I was muted there. So it depends on what kind of photographer you are or what you like to take photos of. I like all kinds of photos. I particularly like landscapes. And I like, when I look at my photos afterwards, and I imagine this happens when other people look at them, I like to know that their eye is just kind of moving around and not ever really stopping. It might stop and, you know, drink in one area for a little while, but then, you know, it will move to another part of the photo. So I'm very interested in having little tricks inside my photos to help the viewer's eye guide along the path. You know, like a a rat through a labyrinth to find some cheese. So the way you do this is you can have visual cues that the human eye naturally will follow, right? If you ever have like a path, like you said, a road or a little game trail or something, instinctively, your eye doesn't start at the end of it. Your eye always starts at the beginning of it and then moves to the end of it and kind of bounces back and forth with like the border of what's along it. Like, is it along a cliff's edge, or is it along water or leaves or grass or whatever? And then at the end of that path, here's the other little trick, is you have to have something that takes their eye to another part of the photo, right? Like a line from the sun or something from the clouds or some kind of indication that their eye is allowed to leave the end of the path and move up to another quadrant. And then it drifts around and catches another line that moves to the other side of the photo. It just kind of keeps going in sort of this Mobius around the photo. Anyway, one of the best ways to do this is by having some kind of path in the photo. Okay. Sort of strange answer. Sorry about that.
Strange and wonderful. That was a good answer.
Karen, do you have a question?
From my my polled people, and this is a good one. If one has previously used Photoshop and is, you know, reasonably comfortable with the basics over there, what are the perks to switching to Lightroom?
Aha. Well, that's usually the opposite of the way most people pose the question. They say, oh, I'm in Lightroom. How much harder is Photoshop? So if you are a Photoshop veteran, I don't think that's even the right way to say it, because very few people would call themselves Photoshop veteran. Or if they would call themselves that, then they're probably annoying people. But if you, let's say you're good with Photoshop, you're okay. Moving into Lightroom is nothing. It's nothing. It's so much simpler. Really, Lightroom is usually the gateway drug into getting into Photoshop. And you can do so much with Lightroom nowadays, you can make a strong case you don't ever need Photoshop. I know, exactly. For example, Thomas Hawk is almost exclusively in Lightroom. And there's so many plugins for Lightroom now. You go crazy in Lightroom. In fact, next week, you watch Trey's Variety Hour, we have someone from Adobe on. And this is the product manager in charge of Lightroom, and he'll be giving us all kinds of tips. And that's a question I'm going to ask him. I'm like, well, are you guys like purposely keeping awesomeness out of Lightroom because you want people to buy Photoshop? I think there's probably some truth to that. He'll never say yes, but I'll at least ask him. But anyway, Lightroom is quite simple compared to Photoshop. I know Lightroom is less intimidating. It's easier to learn. Photoshop can be more intimidating, although it doesn't have to be.
It serves a purpose, though. Would you say that you know, for the most part, you do stuff in Lightroom and then go to Photoshop when you want to get more involved in what, layers or secret sauce or plugins? Or like nowadays, how would you do that as a second part to the question I just asked?
Well, one reason that I spend a lot of time in Photoshop is because I like to do things to only bits of the photo. Okay. And that's easier to do in Photoshop. Oftentimes the Lightroom, the adjustments you make are across the whole thing, which is fine. There's some effects you do want to be across the whole thing. But sometimes you just want to make an adjustment to one particular part of the photo. And so Photoshop is especially adept at that. And I find that there are more robust plugins that are available for Photoshop.
Very good answer.
Sure. Okay, before we get to Keith's question and Sly's question, we make another round. I see one came in here from Google Plus. This is from Dror Beckerman. Okay. Dror says, hey, Trey, I recently bought your HDR course and I wanted to get your recommendation about what camera to buy, since I can't really afford the Nikon D800 right now. This really does sound like an infomercial, doesn't it? So anyway, he goes on to say, I'm traveling the world for the past 3 months, and I found out that I love, capital L-O-V-E, taking pictures, so I need to get a better camera than the small Canon point-and-shoot I have. Can you tell me which DSLR, Canon or Nikon, you think is great at a mid-range level, something in the area of $1,000 to $1,500? Okay. So, Dror, D-R-O-R, Dror, this is a hard question to answer, and I've been battling with it a lot myself. You know, on my recommendations page on the website under stuff I like, I used to have, you know, all DSLRs for entry level, mid-range, and advanced. But increasingly, I'm having trouble recommending DSLRs for that mid-range price point because, you know, getting involved with a DSLR is kind of like getting involved with an arranged Indian marriage. I mean, you're into it for a long time, for a few bolts of cloth. And then you're going to be stuck with this DSLR and all these lenses for a long time. And I hate to get people to overcommit to something like that. So I think that you should immediately divorce yourself from this idea that you're investing into a system with lenses, right? And you're going to be swapping out the body over time. I think that whole idea may be fading away, and you'll just think about getting a whole new camera system every 2 or 3 or 4 years. That seems to be the trajectory of things. And so anyway, since you're not going to have to invest into a Canon or Nikon system, currently, I recommend this Sony NEX7. This is the camera that I bought and I love. It's a great mid-range camera. There's tons of lenses for it. There's enough lenses for it where you can make your round-the-world trip and get the kind of photos you want. There's going to be more lenses for it in the future. If you do want a system that has a whole lot of lenses, then go with one of the Micro Four Thirds cameras, which a lot of people like. There's even more lenses available for that. And the nice thing about these smaller mirrorless cameras like the NEX7 or a Micro Four Thirds is that they're smaller, they're lighter, you can take great photos without carrying around all this junk. You got a new NEX7, didn't you, Karen?
And so did you. Yeah, it was. What?
I did too.
Yeah, I did. I actually shot there was this really rad, crazy looking sunset when we were traveling in Utah because of the smoke. And I got out my rig and I did my, you know, 7 shots and this and that. And then just because I was just being a camera spaz, I pulled out the NEX7 and I took a couple single shots, and those are the ones I ended up using. And it was on auto. So it was kind of like, wow, I actually kind of like that better. It was kind of weird. Yeah, it's a good camera.
And Keith, how do you, because you were in the exact same boat as this question asker.
Yeah, I mean, I love my NX7, or I'm still learning to use it. Although when I have it mounted on a tripod and I'm carrying it around that way, the smaller size and weight are less significant than when I'm carrying it by itself.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I use it on automatic settings. I use it on manual settings. It's been a perfect fit for what I do. I mean, I like it.
Yeah, it's a good camera, all right. So, Keith, you have a question. It's your turn.
Okay, and I'm a little embarrassed to ask this question, but when I'm new to serious digital photography, but I used to do 35 millimeter photography. And in film photography, you would choose the quality of the film and you would match your ISO settings to that. But in digital photography, there is no such marriage. ISO settings are just another tool to manipulate the light and the resulting photograph. So what are rules or what are standards that I should know for figuring out what the correct ISO settings are when I do manual stuff?
Ah, okay. This is a good question. Well, it's not just in manual that you would be asking this question, but it would be also in aperture priority mode, which is what I recommend. And that's what we kind of do in this tutorial, is a lot of aperture priority mode. And if you want to know my history and thinking about all of this, I did not come from the film world at all, but I am familiar with what you're saying. I know you need to get, you know, ISO 800 film if you're going to a certain situation, and you kind of load up your camera ahead of time because you know what situation you're going into. So I came into photography wonderfully unburdened by this thought process. In fact, you know, since I'm all self-taught, I didn't even really know what the heck ISO was. I came to know it very much in my own way. And this is the way that I teach it, is the way I figured it out on my own, because I think it just makes sense. So let's say that you're kind of, you know, Keith, let's say you're at one of your crazy Disney parties, okay, and it's kind of late.
Yeah, we have them all the time.
Yeah, I know you do. So let's say you're inside and it's kind of dark, okay, and you've got your Sony NEX7 there, and you're taking photos, and you have a good lens, so you're at a low f-stop. Let's say you're shooting at f4, for example. But your photos are still coming out kind of blurry, right? They're not looking sharp. Well, if you're still figuring this stuff out at this point, you're like, oh, why is my photo blurry? What I would do is look at your ISO, okay, and just double it. And whatever it is, double it. It doesn't matter what it is. If it was 200, double it to 400, and then take another photo. And if it's still a little blurry, you'll notice that it's less blurry and it's a little bit brighter. You'll go, this is an indication that I'm going in the right direction. Go ahead and double it again to 800, and you'll see it's a little less blurry and a little brighter. Go, this is definitely the right direction in this situation. And then go and double it again to 1600, and then at that point, you'll probably have a nice, clean shot. So anyway, that's a long way of saying, take a photo. If it's too dark, start doubling your ISO until it's clean. Okay.
And how do you, it does help? But how do you know to focus on the ISO instead of the aperture, for example? Or,
well, this is why learning the aperture priority mode is very effective, because these are the only two things you need to worry about: aperture and ISO. Right? By playing with these two levers, you can create almost any kind of photo. In that situation where it's dark, you do want to keep your f-stop as low as you can, like an f4 or even f2 if your lens gets down that low. Because when that number is low, that means a lot of light is getting into the camera, as much light as can get into the camera. Then by adjusting your ISO, you can make your sensor more sensitive. So, of course, in a dark situation, you should try to keep your f-stop as low as you can, which means then that you get to, you just kind of lock that into place, and then you play with your ISO until you get a clean photo.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Let me ask another question. There's another question from the blog. This is from Roni Santoso. He says, Trey, could you please share how to care for the camera while shooting in a snowy area? Yes, I was just out shooting in snow two days ago. And I no longer have one of these big professional bodies. A big professional body would be considered like a D3X or a D3S or D4. I've recently switched from that to, I guess, what could be arguably called a mid-range, a D800, which has a smaller body and is kind of less weather rugged than one of these big cameras. So that means I've been more worried about it in these weathery situations. So you basically don't want it to get wet. Okay, just try to. If you have a pro body, don't worry about it getting wet. It's not a big deal. But if it's a mid-range or low-level body, just try not to let it get wet. If it's a really cold snow, the snow probably won't melt on your camera, so you're okay letting your camera get snowy. Otherwise, you can wrap it inside some Ziploc, or you can take a big Ziploc and cut a hole in the back and kind of tape it. Right? It looks kind of ghetto, right? But it works. The other thing is, maybe you don't have to worry so much about the water. I did something very stupid, and I left my D800 out on the balcony all night. and it was taking photos of stars or something. And then I thought, oh, I'll go out and take another photo of a star. And then I got distracted by Google Plus or some nonsense. And then I woke up in the morning and I thought, oh, my camera's... And so I went out there, it was covered in frost. It was ridiculous. And I brought it inside and I put a hot heater on it for a few hours and it was fine. I was nervous though. Anyway, these cameras are pretty tough and you don't have to do anything special to protect it other than just common sense. Okay, let's slingshot back over to the left and have Andrea. You have another question. You might still be muted.
This is all night. Yeah, I'm good. Okay, so you talked a lot about RAW and shooting in RAW, but what if we have a camera, what if we're taking a photo that we know for sure we just want to post online? I need to take a picture of some little boys that have autism for my website, and it's these little twins that I know, and they're cute as heck, and I don't really want these, they're not going to go anywhere but my website. Do I still need to shoot in RAW?
Yes, I would still shoot in RAW, because you'll be able to do more with the photo afterwards.
Even for just online, huh?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because, your RAW photo, you'll be able to really do a lot of adjustments with it. You're still, after you do your adjustments in Lightroom, you're still going to export it as a JPEG. Okay. So it's going to end up a JPEG, but you just have a lot more control, from RAW until JPEG, rather than just JPEG, you really don't have that many choices left anymore. And by the way, here's a little hint for shooting pictures of kids. This is one thing adults always do, is adults always take pictures downward looking at kids. But if you just get down on your knees and shoot at their eye level, the photo is so much more interesting. It's more personal, it's everything. So just, it's a tiny little thing you can do at birthday parties or whatever kid's situation, just get down to their level.
Great tip. Thank you very much.
Sure. And also, we've been going like well over an hour here, but there's still lots of questions. And so, you know, I'm willing to go longer if you guys are up for it. Is that cool?
We're up. Although Krista's not going to be up much longer because she's a brainiac, and that brain needs sleep and juice.
It needs food.
Stuff. Needs, yeah.
It's true. I have to jump out in a few minutes. But I can wait until Anne does hers. That's okay.
Oh, we know you have better things to do, like sleep. No offense, Krista. Geez. She's like, oh, I'm having fun, but I'd really rather be sleeping.
Young and smart and still needs that sleep. You know, you get all old and jazzed up. You don't need that anymore.
Okay, we can stay around for a little while then. Okay, so Anne, ask your question.
Sure. So for processing, what are like the three most basic editing features that you use when you're beautifying a photo or making it better?
Yes. Okay. It depends on the situation. Like I hate to begin answers with it depends, because whenever someone begins an answer by saying it depends, I feel like half the audience tunes out, like, oh, it's going to be a complex answer. But I won't say it depends. I'll say it like this. Okay, if it's a landscape photo, the three most important sliders are clarity. Okay, this is a Lightroom slider. It's a weird slider, right? It doesn't really mean sharpness, although it does make things sharper. It changes the contrast almost on a pixel by pixel level. It does something very, very nice. So clarity will make almost any landscape photo look better. The other one that I'll adjust, you asked for three, which is an arbitrary number. As long as you're doing three, you might as well adjust seven, by the way. But if you were just going to pick just three, clarity, and then I would drop down your highlights and increase your shadows. So those three. Okay.
What software are you using? Because Clarity, I don't think. Okay.
Adobe Lightroom. I know you're with Google and you probably just use Picasa, but you should go ahead and you just get Adobe Lightroom. It's the best. People use it. Good people use it. Adobe's not a sponsor, by the way. I still recommend. I recommend stuff whether or not it's sponsored. By the way, I only take sponsors of stuff I actually use. So anyway, but get Adobe Lightroom. It's good. And then play with those sliders. Okay, so if it's a people person, a people shot, a person shot, then it depends on if it's what you're going for. Okay, clarity is still very valuable in a people shot. Okay. But if you increase the clarity, you can make them look a little bit hard-edged, you know, but maybe that's what you want for a certain kind of photo. But if you slide it over to the left, the person can become more kind of dreamy and ghost-like and soft. So clarity is a valuable slider in the people situation as well. But it you know, depends on what you're going for. Contrast is also very good for people shots. Another thing that's very good for people's shots is way down at the bottom of a Lightroom, there's a vignette slider. And if you increase the vignette and kind of darken up the edges a little bit, it draws all the attention in on the person that's there in the photo. It's a very subtle thing. Most 99% of people that look at your photo will not even notice that you've done a vignette. They'll just notice that the center of your photo seems very bright. And all their attention is going to the center. So anyway, there you go. And by the way, if you choose to stay in Picasso, which is fine, I don't mean to browbeat you into Adobe, but
oh, sure.
If you do stay in Picasso, there are probably analogs to those sliders over there, although I don't know what they are.
There is definitely vignette, though, on Picasso. So.
Yeah, everybody has vignette. That's an easy one. Okay, Krista.
All right, so I have another composition question for you. Yes. So, they have all these, you know, rule of thirds and the golden rule and these various composition guidelines.
The golden rule, evidence? That's something else.
Well,
the golden rule is
golden ratio.
Have done unto you or something like that.
Sorry, golden ratio. That's okay. And I was wondering if you knew whether there was any actual evidence for these kind of things. Do they actually work? Or is it just kind of voodoo that people do to try to guess whether the photo is going to draw lines well, or how does it work?
Yes, I have very strong opinions on this rule of thirds. I think it is, I don't think it's based on anything. I think it's like an old wives' tale or some chestnut that's got passed down from generation to generation. And I think, in fact, you know, okay, so I think it's based on something which is right, which is, you don't have to put the subject of your photo in the center, okay? That's the spirit of the rule of thirds. Although it has been bastardized into this thing that beginner teachers haul out, you know, at any occasion. You'll also notice, by the way, that if you get a lot of comments, people that always comment like, oh, you really did well on the rule of thirds. People that leave this comment are always beginning photography students that have just, they're kind of hauling out this thing that their teacher told them because they feel like they have some great discovery with this rule of thirds, which I think is all based on a farce. But the spirit of it is right in that the center of the photo is not the subject. I think actually if you were to come up with where it came from, I think back in the day, they said, okay, well, we don't want our students, this is not some sort of collective photography teacher Illuminati that came up with this thing. I think it was just sort of a ground up type thing, a bottom up thing. And they said, okay, well, we don't want students to put their subject in the middle, so we should give them some kind of rule. We should say, instead of putting it at the rule of one half, right, we should say the rule of thirds, because that's a little out to the side. Then if they just go there, then they're off center and it's okay. And I think what happened is that this got told to people, or it's in some very early level book, and then it's just been passed on over time as this great truth of photography. Anyway, really, frankly, if you look at some of the best photos out there, and I even noticed this with not just my own photos, but other photos that I think are interesting, it doesn't always follow the rule of thirds. It's close to the rule of thirds. There is this golden ratio. This ratio that is sort of this perfect, beautiful point. It's close to there, not quite there. And if you do use Lightroom, it is an overlay that you can turn on. By default, of course, rule of thirds is on because it's this ridiculous thing that got passed on and now is in our products and everywhere. But you can go change it to the golden ratio and then get things to line up along there if you're not quite sure or if you just don't feel it. I notice that some people are just naturally good at composition. Everything just falls together. You know, they don't even try. It just happens. And that's great. You don't have any problems if that's you. But if you are someone that struggles with composition, turn on that golden ratio overlay and line up things along there, like if it's a person, but the center of their eyes along that point of the golden ratio. And that could help you compose. Okay. Is that good, Krista?
With that, I should probably jump out. But okay. I really appreciate coming on. I miss you guys.
Will you actually jump? Because that'd be cool.
What?
Yeah. Would you actually jump? Because that would actually be cool. I would enjoy that. Just like,
yeah, and I'm sure the male viewers would appreciate that.
Just a jump. Anyway. Oh, this is a leap.
All right, take care, guys.
Okay, don't throw all male viewers under the bus there. We have a tiny bit amount of self-respect, not much.
But... Oh, good.
All right. Bye, Krista.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you guys, too.
Ditto.
And Trey, don't be mad at me, but I have to jump, too.
What?
I'm mad. I'm totally mad now.
And all the women are leaving now.
Yeah.
I put my dog in his crate, and he's been, you guys don't know, but he's been barking his tail off because he's been in there for 2 hours. I feel really bad.
Okay. All right. You can go in.
She's going to pull the barking dog claws.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. This was really fun, and I learned a ton.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Cool.
Thanks for coming in.
Bye, Ann.
Bye.
Thanks.
Okay, now it's your turn, Karen.
For God's sake. Okay, would you like one from my list, or would you like one from Google
Plus? Give me one from your list.
Okay, so here's one. I hear this one a lot, which is we have our people who believe in absolutely composing your photo, you know, and your crop in the camera, and then there are some that like to leave a little breathing room for cropping later. How important is it to compose the photo in the camera so that you don't have to crop it later? Or even is it?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Of course it is.
In fact, I was with our friend Tom.
Oh. You know,
and we were up shooting down on Waikiki. And I really enjoyed zooming in to 300 millimeter and finding particular groups of buildings to take photos of. And he was, I don't know, complaining probably isn't the right word, but he was like not finding the shot that he wanted. So his decision...
He wasn't whining, was he?
No.
No, he doesn't do that.
No, he wasn't whining. He was just concerned that he didn't feel like he found the composition that he wanted in particular. So he decided just to take a wide photo of everything and then decide later. And I actually think that's fine. That's not a problem, especially because today's cameras are all so good and so multi-megapixel that you can zoom in and find stuff. And this was I think in the first tutorial we did last year, this is one of the lessons, one of the pieces of homework that we had for the HDR tutorial. And that was, this is not anything to do with HDR, just like very little of what I talk about has to do with HDR. But one of the lessons was to take a great big photo and then see how many smaller photos you can make out of it. Enjoy doing this myself from time to time, and I should do it more. I profess this stuff, but I don't actually do it. I should, because I enjoy it when I do it. When I have this nice, epic photo of a nice landscape, but there's all kinds of nice stuff and it all feels good. There's no reason that I couldn't go in and put together nice little squares or little rectangles or different kinds of things. So anyway, I think that's a perfectly valid way. Just if you're not sure, take a photo of the whole shoot and match, and then later in Lightroom, go crop up some nice little compositions.
Awesome.
Yes. Okay, Keith.
Trey, you touched on this a little bit when you mentioned taking photos of children at eye level. And in your video, you were crouching down for the shot that you were doing in the landscape. How often do you crouch for your photos? I think there's a tendency for most first-timers to do things straight at standing up eye level, especially if you got a tripod involved in that. And I'm wondering, what do you use as a rule? Is it just simply you like one thing versus another? Or how often do you actually end up crouching instead of just standing for a photo?
Well, you probably know what it's like, Keith. It takes a lot of effort to crouch, right? I mean, it's like, you know, I guess not that I'm old or anything, but, you know, I'm not 10. So if you're going down low with your camera, all your equipment, you think, it's a little bit of a commitment, isn't it? Because you're going down. There's no doubt about it. You think about it more than you. I saw there was this, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He was giving a speech, and not that he's any great speech giver or anything, but he opened with a joke, and I don't remember the exact nature of it, but he said he was talking about having to bend over and tie his shoes and what an effort this is for him. And his little joke was, he goes, while I'm down there, I always see if there's anything else I could be doing while I'm down here. And that's what I feel like sometimes when I got to crouch down for a shot. So yeah, it does take a little bit more effort. And the thing is, speaking of composition, there is something quite magical that happens to you as a photographer, at some point. And, as you know, I know we have various people in here at various shades of gray from beginner to intermediate, and what happens is that you, when you get started, let's say you get started and there's a flower vase on the table, okay? And then you take a photo of the flower vase and it looks kind of nice, right? And then you move over to the other side of the table and you take another photo, then you move sideways, so you're starting to, you move your body around, you take photos of the flower vase on the table in different configurations, and then you start to decide, oh, okay, well, this is a little bit better than that one, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, you're still learning, and you're walking around, and you might see a interesting door handle, or you just see something interesting. And then you move your physical body around it. You take photos from different angles as you learn what's interesting and what's not interesting. Well, at some point, you stop moving your body, and you just move your mind, right? You just know what the flower vase will look like from that side of the table. You know what this ornate door handle will look like if you stood 3 feet in this direction. You don't have to move your body to know what the composition is going to be like. And this is very wonderful. This is something that actually photographers take for granted, that we're able to extend our consciousness in this wide orbit around us and see things from many perspectives. It's an incredible skill. And we do take it for granted because I know other people don't have this skill. And so anyway, in that example of the tree, I did not have to get on my knees to know what it would look like on my knees. I just knew what it would look like. And also, you know, when I'm looking at a mountain or a tree or anything, I don't actually have to walk up to it and switch lenses to know what it's going to look like from that distance with that lens. I just know what it will look like. So you become incredibly efficient, and you have to crouch down about, you know, one magnitude less than you used to when you didn't extend your consciousness down into the knee area.
I look forward to reaching that then.
Yeah. All right. Yes.
Oh, as if on cue, there's two things that occurred to me. One of them is an outreach or an outcropping of my previous cropping question, which I hope you don't mind that I ask, but also in that way that I don't actually have to move to know that Sly has another fabulous question. And I just wanted to to tell you that I'm that good that I know both of these things because my mind goes there and I'm sitting here. Would you like the cropping question first, though?
Yes.
Because we were talking cropping in the camera a second ago, and Taylor Jenkins from Google Plus says, I've always been a bit confused about cropping and image proportions. So when cropping, do you simply free crop or do you try to maintain a certain image proportion or size format? When would you choose one over the other?
Yes, I always free crop, although I never heard that word before.
I like that. It's kind of like a race, like a jockey. It kind of
freaks. Go commando.
Yeah.
Commando.
Commando cropping.
Yeah. Yeah, no, frankly, it reminds me of free balling, which is.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, commando. That's what guys think of.
Yeah, they do. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. Well, girls don't think about that stuff.
We do now.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
So, okay. Anyway, I do occasionally free crop it, I guess. And the reason that I do that is because I don't really care about traditional proportions. This used to be a big deal for printing, right? Because you needed to print it to fit a certain kind of frame or to fit a certain kind of develop. If you're going to develop on a certain kind of paper, dimension of paper, you got to go 4x3 or whatever. But I find that I rarely ever use any of the traditional cropping constraints. If I feel like, oh, the top part of the sky is a little ugly, you know, I better pare it down a little bit. Or feel like, oh, the bottom of this photo is quite boring, I'll just kind of crop it on up. You know, I don't give any concern at all as to whether or not it fits traditional constraint. And with printing nowadays, it doesn't even matter. There is an asterisk to that. Some places I get my work printed and they'll print whatever dimensions. It doesn't matter how I cropped it. They'll do the print exactly how I cropped it, no matter how strange my cropping. But with SmugMug, I do notice that the customer can choose from various preordained constraints. And what it does is it puts a little window over my photo, right? And it will crop out something that doesn't fit by it, like a 16x9, for example. It will just crop some stuff off. It bothers me a little bit, but it's not the end of the world. And, you know, still that middle part of the photo is still interesting as long as they're not cutting a horse's head in half or anything. It doesn't really bother me. So anyway, I'm a free cropper.
Free cropper. Anyway.
So let's go with Sly. Sly, yes.
Sly.
Yes. Okay, Trey. I've started out shooting exclusively in manual mode. And so I just recently, this isn't a question for me, but I think it's relevant for a lot of newbies. And I just started shooting events and literally just put my camera in auto mode for the first time in 15 months, 16 months of being a photographer, which is kind of odd. And I just learned the incredible value of using exposure compensation. And so I just wanted to, it's not so much a question, I guess it is, but I wanted to see if maybe you could just kind of give everybody a breakdown of exposure compensation, how it works and when it's a most effective tool, and what are your thoughts on exposure compensation?
Yeah, so exposure compensation allows you to take a photo and make it brighter or darker than it might naturally come out. And sometimes people come into exposure compensation because they take a photo in a certain situation and it's just too dang dark. You're like, why is it too dark? Well, there's a few ways to solve the darkness problem, but one way is to hold down the exposure compensation button and then move your little slider so that it gets brighter, like +1, for example. +1 means it will be one stop brighter. And then the photo will just come out brighter. And by the way, this is the whole reason that auto bracketing was created. HDR photographers, we use auto bracketing to make HDRs, but auto bracketing wasn't made for HDR. Frankly, we're hacking the camera. We're hacking the auto bracketing to use in our own nefarious way. But if you don't want to mess with exposure compensation, right, which takes a little bit of forethought, maybe it takes some premeditation. Say like, okay, I'm going to do two stops brighter or two stops darker for this situation. Chances are the situation is fairly fluid and you don't know really what you're going to need. You might as well not do exposure compensation and turn on auto bracketing. And in auto bracketing, it will take the normal photo just as it normally would have taken, but it will also take at least two other photos, maybe one at a minus two exposure compensation and a plus two exposure compensation. So you'll end up with a dark one, a normal one, and a bright one. But if you're in a weird situation, maybe you'll end up with two dark ones and one perfect one, or one perfect one and two ones that are way too bright. So anyway, as long as you're doing exposure compensation, you might as well just go into auto bracketing mode just to cover all the bases. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. That's fabulous. Yeah, that's a great answer.
Thanks, man.
Well, thanks. So we have another question coming from the internet.
Yes. Google Plus and David Gray have a question about HDR. How does one get a smooth, natural-looking HDR that still has detail in them but retain the saturation? let's see, I'm trying to get the retain the saturation. He has a photo that he points to which is missing a bit of edge and contrast definition, and he feels that his shots always look like they've been overprocessed despite using conservative settings. Thanks for that.
Sorry. We gave each other the giggles there behind the scenes. Sorry about that, K-Hut.
Yeah, well, whatever.
We are broadcast professionals, right?
Yeah. Oh, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yep. Don't try this at home, folks. Wait.
Right.
We are home.
We're not. Karen is doing this for... episode series with me at the month. We will not have that kind of tomfoolery.
or we might. Who knows?
No, we'll be very professional. That's appropriate.
He can't stop laughing saying that, so I don't know what to believe.
No, I will not play practical jokes on you during this serious thing. Okay.
Yeah, very serious.
So this is a kind of an overall HDR question, and from David. And here's the answer. And this is sort of meta, but I think it will make sense. The answer is not to make the whole photo HDR, okay? Very few of my photos, in fact, hardly any, are like completely HDR'd, all right? It doesn't mean that it's like I create an HDR and then I layer in the original and there's like a 50-50. It doesn't mean that at all. What it means is that there's sections of the photo that are very textured and quite HDR, while there's other parts of the photo that have almost no or zero HDR at all. And so this will help you get away from these more rough HDRs. You said you want something more smooth and more overall satisfying. The answer, kind of like is my answer to the sharpness back at the beginning of our Q&A, is not to have equal levels of sharpness everywhere, but to have it vacillate in various parts of the photo. The same thing goes for HDR. Don't have it all be equal level of HDR. Have it oscillate as it goes from one part of the photo to the next, and you'll end up with an overall more satisfying result. Cool. Well, let's go for one more round of questions. Andrea, over there.
Yay, awesome. Okay, so Trey, I love to travel too, and I've found myself getting overwhelmed just with my cute little Canon Rebel and an extra lens, and I do lots of workcation, so I'll go somewhere for like a long weekend and, you know, just work during the day and play at night and on the weekend and stuff, and it's a lot to manage. How do you manage your equipment when you travel?
Yes. it's tough to manage your equipment when you travel, because you've got all your camera stuff, you've got your bag, and I have more than most because I have a tripod, and that's a commitment. You know, it's like, you know, you decide to carry on an umbrella sometimes just in case it rains. Like, oh, that's a commitment to carry an umbrella. So it's basically that to the next extreme. It's like, oh, I'm just going to carry a tripod with me everywhere for the rest of my life. It's like a major... So anyway, your whole attitude changes once you think, oh, okay, well, like a tripod is just part of my life now, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there is sort of a attitudinal thing, I guess. They're like, okay, you know, I'm not going to half-ass it. I'm going to carry this tripod. And I guess it, even if you're not into tripods, if you just have this situation you're talking about, like, oh, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to carry the stuff I need when I want it. You know, I'm going to have a bigger than average woman's purse, and I'm going to carry around a big camera and some lenses, and I'm not going to try to do it halfway. I'm just going to do it, you know? And then, you know, that once you kind of decide like, okay, I'm going to take this stuff more seriously, and that becomes a part of your kit, then it's just part of your kit. You know, it's just part of you. It's natural. It's not like you're forcing it anymore. It's just there. The other possibility is to go, and I got a very annoying cut. So I've got this article on the website, which still collects so many comments every day. It's this DSLRs are a dying breed article. I mean, there's so many comments. It's just ridiculous. And I do read all the comments everywhere, frankly, except for that article, because they're so predictable now. Because I think what's happening is, so there's all these, okay, this is the reason I bring this up, Andrea, because this is, it has to do with taking around big DSLRs and big lenses everywhere. Okay. And there's a lot of guys that are really into big cameras and big lenses. It's not just, you know, I say that as sort of it's not a joke. I mean, there's guys that are like really, really proud of their big cameras and big lenses and carrying all this stuff around. It almost seems to define them as a man. I mean, I'm not kidding. They take this stuff very seriously, and I can tell we get groups of comments, like they come in 10, 20, 30 at a time, and it's whenever some camera club has some really hardcore gearhead forum, and they go, ah, there's this guy, Trey Ratcliffe, he has this article on his site that says DSLRs are a dying breed, and we're all going to be carrying around smaller cameras in the future. And then they all like, they get the internet pitchforks out and the torches, and they come to the blog and like, you're wrong. DSLRs are dying. And who can't carry around a DSLR? What's wrong? And so we get a lot of these just ridiculous comments, and a lot of them are like, the weight's not a problem. But really, of the vast majority of women I've talked to, who you can make an argument that 50% of photographers are women, they do have trouble carrying around big cameras and big lenses, and they don't want to do it.
Laptops, and, yeah.
They just don't want to do it. They think it's, you know, it's unnecessary, and it frankly is unnecessary with all these new mirrorless cameras that are coming out. This NEX7, it's 24 megapixel. Sure, it's not full frame, but the thing is that if you're a photographer and you don't know the difference, there's another question somewhere in here about cropped frame and full frame. I highlighted it. I don't know where it is.
Let's see.
I want to make sure that I call out that person, because it was a good question.
That's me, Trey.
Was that you? Oh, that was you. Well, I'll jump ahead and answer, because I think you asked me ahead of time about if this would be an interesting question. I thought it would be. So I'll answer your question slide without you asking. And it is the difference in a cropped sensor and a full-frame sensor. And that's a knock against these mirrorless cameras currently, is that they're cropped sensors. But here's the secret about cropped sensors versus full frame sensors is that if you're a beginner or intermediate photographer, you're probably using a cropped sensor and you didn't know it. Okay. You don't know that you're using crop sensor and there's nothing wrong with it. You might notice, for example, that sometimes when you want to take a photo of like a car, right? And you're taking a photo of a car, you think, oh, I can't quite fit the whole car in. I guess I should back up a few steps and then you can fit the car in. Okay. They go, well, that's not so bad. I mean, you just kind of get used to having a crop sensor. You get used to having to back up to take photos or to fit certain things in if you don't have a wide angle lens. And then once you do get a full frame sensor, you think, oh, I can see so much more, right? But you didn't know that before. So you're perfectly fine with a crop sensor along the way. So anyway, this is another thing that the DSLR, you know, big iron crowd laments.
Where does Micro Four Thirds fit in that discussion?
Ah, well, there is a sliding scale of sensor size, like all the way from full framed down to like, you know, APS-C and even smaller. And Micro Four Thirds is somewhere in that constellation. Still, if you're a full frame, you know, elitist gearhead nerd, then Micro Four Thirds is, you know, that's for children. But really, frankly, you know, all of us know you can take a perfectly good photo with an APS-C sensor or a Micro Four Thirds sensor, any kind of sensor, really. Anyway, so that's all a long way of saying, Andrea, that you're not going to have to carry around a big camera with big lenses in the future. You can do a lot with a sleek little camera with these sleek little light lenses. You can have almost any kind of photo you want to with that kind of sensor.
That's really cool. I think you're right, though. I think it's a commitment thing. I've been lugging my laptop and lugging my camera around everywhere I go. And I went to Portland just this last weekend, and I didn't take it because I had to take two laptops. And the second I got there and saw the Broadway Bridge, I'm like, oh, why didn't I bring my camera? I was so disappointed. So anyway, I'm committed. But I think that's three-fourths of my battle right there.
Cool. Cool.
Thank you.
Sure. No problem. So Keith and Sly, we'll get questions from you guys and take a few more from the internet, and then we'll wrap it up. So go for it, Keith.
I don't really have another question at the moment other than how are you keeping Sly so quiet in this hangout?
Oh, I'm muted because I guess I was feeding back. So I have been laughing, and I've been wanting to interject every 30 seconds for whatever it's worth, Keith.
Whatever you want to. I didn't lay any kind of edict down that you can't. What did you want to interject about? You can interject after the fact.
Oh, it's too late now.
All right. Oh, totally. Yeah, we'd have to rewind the whole show.
No, I am going to have. I can tell I'm going to have some more questions when you start delving into Lightroom more. But I'm still digesting a lot of stuff that you've talked about now. So,
cool. Okay. Well, Sly, you go right ahead.
Shoot, Trey, you kind of asked my last question. Other than I had a joke question on my little list, and I won't bother asking that because it's just silly. maybe I'll think of another one in a second here.
We never do silly around here at all.
Yeah, let's not do that. No, yeah.
If a train leaves Portland, no.
That's a math question.
Karen, pull in one from the internets for us.
How about this one about filters?
Sure.
Mike Miller from Google Plus sort of did a little threefer right here. Do you recommend any filters? I understand what a darkening filter can do and one day hope to get some, but how about UV filters, polarizers, or filters that tint either the whole shot or just part of it? Are they valuable tools?
I do not use any filters at all. I know some people really like using filters and stuff, but I just go straight to the glass. And the thing is that I like... all my filters are really later, right, in Photoshop. And to me, it seems sort of arbitrary as to where you put the filter before or after you take the photo. I have the same opinions basically on lighting, right? There's a lot of people that will go through great effort to set up flashes and lights and use situations so that things are properly lit before the photo is taken. And they consider those of us that adjust the lights after the photo was taken. That's wrong. You can't do that, but you can adjust everything you want to before. So anyway, this whole kind of like before the photo was taken versus after the photo was taken. When should you do things? There's no right or wrong way to do it. But personally, I just take a clean photo with no filters at all right away. And then I do all that kind of filtering stuff later. There's also a practical problem with my wide angle lens. I use this Nikon 14-24, which is sort of this weird bulbous shape on it. And you can't quite put filters on it. You can get these Lee filters, right? But then it's got this big old piece of iron that hangs in front, this square thing, and then you have to like put these glass squares into it. It seems ridiculous to me in a way. You got to carry on all this stuff.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, so I'm not into all the filter stuff.
What about when you use your cell phone?
Yeah, well, I use filters, but that's all, you know, again, in post-processing. Yeah, I think the filters that he's asking about here are like polarizers or things. Like, I know my friend Gordon, he was really into using polarizers for a while. And like, he went to Easter Island and used polarizers because it does this cool stuff to the sky, right? It makes the sky seem really inky blue, especially for blown out skies. It makes it look quite cool. But he can't ever dial that back. That inky polarized blue is baked into his photos forever, which can be kind of harsh. I know he laments that a little bit. So anyway, I don't really use any filters. Any other big burning questions out there that you guys want me to get to before we wrap it up? I know there's a ton more on all the various internets, and we'll keep track of that stuff, and we'll get to them. Basically, what we'll do in the final thing, Karen, and you're going to be my question wrangler.
Okay. Or wranglerette, as it were.
Wranglerette.
Yeah.
What we'll do in each of these four things is we'll show the video, sort of the premiere of the video. Everyone gets to watch it together. And then we'll have an extended Q&A after each one. And the questions will be basically around the first part of the video. But we'll have, I mean, it seems like this is something that go on and on and on. Obviously, I really enjoy talking about it. I'm happy to answer questions. And I don't even mind answering the same kind of question in different ways. Because you might notice, and I think I might just do this for my own sanity, is that whenever I get a question, even if it's like mega basic, right? I actually like to think of the answer again. Like, you know, I like to really analyze the foundations of the question and put it all back together again, like Humpty Dumpty. So, you know, I have a few ideas that I always return to, but I always do like to. I really enjoy answering questions in new ways. So don't ever, if something isn't clear, or maybe you didn't like the analogy I gave or didn't quite resonate with you, you know, ask again and I'll give a different analogy that might resonate in a new way. Anyway, so I'm happy to answer all these questions.
And there were some questions in the Twitch chat room too that came up.
Ah, was there anything that you want to pop off?
No, they're pretty far back now, but I think you might want to include it in the flow.
That's not very helpful, Keith.
I'm sorry. I did ask one of them, so I did get it out there.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, there's so many. You can't possibly cover them all, so.
Yeah, we'll get to them. It's a long life, Kay Hutt.
Yep. Trey, I have another question I'd like to ask, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know a lot of people struggle with this, and right now I'm trying to teach Charlie some stuff about kind of getting a grasp on the three main variables of exposure, ISO, shutter speed, and aperture. And do you have any like particular drills, you know, for people to really kind of wrap their heads around the relationship between those three variables? I know it's a lot of people struggle with it, and they bounce back and forth, and they try to figure out how these things, you know, work together. And outside of extensive, you know, fiddling with your camera, you know, I see some people, they draw little triangles and they have different methods of, you know, visualization and explaining this. Is there any particular tool that you'd like to share with anybody of assembling those three things?
I hate those triangles. Those are the most ridiculous things.
I agree.
What happened, you know, the people that draw these triangles to explain aperture and ISO and all this stuff, they're often like really smart people, right? And then they come up with this incredibly complex system, which you have to get to understand their system for thinking. And then once you understand their system for thinking, then maybe you could figure out the subject matter at hand, which is f-stop and ISO and shutter and all this stuff. And it reminds me a little bit of, there's this guy I really like named Richard Feynman. He's a physicist. And he has a great book called The Pleasure of Figuring Things Out. And it's sort of an anthology of various papers and speeches he's given. And he gives, I'll answer your question in a moment, by the way, Sly, but this is indirectly related, because this is more just a discussion of the way humans think. And he has this wonderful story about reading a book, and how he can read a book and know when 60 seconds has elapsed. He just is very, very good at that. He can start reading and then just kind of keep track of the time in his head. And at the end of that, he just knows when 60 seconds has elapsed. Okay. And so he was just thinking about that, like, oh, this is quite interesting that I can read a book, and while I'm reading the book and understanding it, I'm also keeping track of how much time is going by, because this is just sort of an interesting thing. And he thinks a lot about the way he thinks. And he was discussing this with another physicist at the university. This is what physicists do, is they get together, they talk about the way people think about things. And the other physicist said, oh, that's impossible. How can you do that? I don't know how you could do that. And so this other physicist tries to do that, and he can't even come close to it. He says, oh, but I can do this other thing, right? He can talk for an extended amount of time and then instantly tell you, like, when that 60 seconds has elapsed. But Feynman is unable to do that. It turns out that one of the physicists, the guy that's able to talk, the way he pictures time is he sees time flipping over, you know, like one of those old clocks, like one of those train station destination things that flips around. This is how he pictures time going by. Where Feynman, in his head, he keeps track of time in sort of a tick-tock kind of way. So there's a disconnect between what he sees and the sound that he hears. And there's a disconnect between the other physicists about what he's saying and what's going on in his head. And so much of what human communication is that, like, when I say something to you, Karen, what you're taking is my words and you're twisting them around to make sense in your brain, right? Because we all have just our own particular way of talking and our own particular way of understanding some people. You might notice that some people you just understand more easily than other people. Some people you will just never quite understand the way they think, because their brain just, every brain evolves a little bit differently. And the words that come out of your brain to explain how you're thinking then have to get plugged into, like, your key never quite fits their lock, right? And so you're always having to, so much brain power is just spent trying to figure out what the hell someone's trying to say. It's an enormous amount of brain power. And so what happens is with photography, f-stop, ISO, and shutter speed, like, we all have this way that we think about it, right? And we have this incredibly complex model, and then we try to explain this complex model to somebody else, and meanwhile, they're trying to put that key into their lock, and it just doesn't fit. And there's so many variables at work. By the time you figure out what one of these variable keys is, your brain has forgotten about everything else, and then it all falls apart into total confusion. And so the more that photography teachers try to explain this stuff, explain the complexity, the more confusing it ends up getting to people. So anyway, that's a long, very long way of saying that I don't teach like that. Drawing triangles and all this nonsense, all it does is confuse people, right? The best way to do it is kind of what I go through in this very first lesson that you got a little hint of, is simply lock down your camera into one aperture, okay? Like F8, for example. That the only thing you have to worry about is ISO. Just keep playing with the ISO up and down to see what it does, okay? Oh, what happens when there's a high number? What happens when there's a low number? Then once you have everything locked down, right, you can't control the shutter speed, you can't control the f-stop, the only thing you can adjust is the ISO, then you really get to understand ISO, okay? And then once you feel like, oh, I think I know what happens now, then you start to move this other one around a little bit. And this is how the brain learns. The brain doesn't learn when there's too many variables changing all the time. It can't figure out any rhyme or reason. It seems almost totally chaotic because it's gray. There's nothing foundational about it. When your whole foundation is constantly moving and flexing, your brain can't figure it out. But if you can lock down two of the three levers and just learn that third one, then you figure it out. And then you lock down the third one, and then you move the second one up and down. And then you're in good shape. So anyway, this is how I like to teach those things, Sly.
Thank you. Answer.
Oh, sorry for the very long answer.
That was an awesome answer.
Yeah.
I agree. Awesome.
Okay.
It explains so much more than you actually said.
Oh, good. Okay.
I think the same thing can be applied to sliders in Lightroom, the same way of learning.
It can be applied to anything and everything. I taught writing. I taught writing for, I don't know, 35 years, and that's how we had to do everything. So it applies, that idea applies across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And only recently since I'm all self-taught in photography, only recently have I, and I, when I say recently, I mean the last 3 years or so, have I learned, I've been doing photography, I guess, 6 years hardcore. But really only the last 3 years have I started to learn how other people learn photography, how it's traditionally taught. And often I see the results of just very confused people that come out of these classes. Like, oh, it's too bad. It's not that hard.
It's sad. It's really, really sad.
So sad. Okay. Well, I'll wrap it up now. Thanks again for all the questions. I'm sorry for all the ones I didn't answer. I really am. I thought I could go on forever, but we should just wrap it up. Okay. So anyway, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Andrea.
Trey, great to see you.
Good to see you too, Andrea. Thank you, K-Hut, Karen Hutton.
You're welcome, T-Rat.
Dude, I want a nickname. Come on.
A-Warren.
No,
A-Warren. A-Warren, that's weird.
I know. I'm trying to work it. I'll work on it. I'll come
okay,
up
you let me know, Karen. Okay.
Yeah, I'll have a move. I also have a move for you because I think a move is kind of important when you have a name. Yeah.
Next time we talk, I expect a nickname and a move.
And a move. Okay. I'm on
Karen
it.
Can
I'm
call,
on it
Karen can call me anything she wants.
Dave, is my audio still a total mess?
No, it's okay.
No, your audio is good. Your audio is good.
Cool. And Trey, would you mind if I plugged my new show that I'm about to have on Google Plus real quick? It's
Let's all plug our shows. It's very relevant.
Actually, I'm going to be starting a show with Gilmar Smith. We're going to be probably going to be airing our first episode within the next 2-3 weeks or so. We're still working on that and getting all the stuff together. We're going to be using Vidcast Network. The name of the show is going to be What the F Stop, and it's very relevant to today's show because the preface of the show is going to be all things amateur photography. And we're going to be welcoming on each show two different guests. One guest, which will be a complete amateur, and somebody who's up and coming and doing good. And we're gonna plug that guy and take a look at his work and talk a little bit about how that person discovered photography and their camera and get some inspirational stories. And then we'll be welcoming a more qualified guest, somebody like Trey. Hopefully, he can be on our show sometime. And we'll get a brief description of what they're up to now and take a look at their current work. And then we're going to rewind that guy back to the beginning and get their inspirational stories and learn about their first experiences with the camera. So it's going to be a very inspirational based kind of amateur photography show. And we're going to be revolving a lot of the content around chat and questions and really involving a lot of other people. You know, we're going to keep the interaction with the guests to about 50%, you know, minimum, and really involve watchers. So I hope everybody gets a chance to take a look and stuff and be on the lookout on my stream. Should be plugging that in the next 2-3 weeks.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Me too. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
very What's cool. your show all about, K-Hut?
Well, T-Rat, it is called Life Through the Lens, and it's a bi-weekly show. Our next show actually is July 13th, and our guest will be Tanya Rochette, who does awesome work with just layers and imagine, you know, it's all photography, but her work is just amazing. Our show, basically, we have one guest per show, and we go behind the lens, or as you like to say, behind the kimono. And talk to people about, you know, what they think about, what they feel, where this whole passion for this art form lives and breathes. And it always ends up being really unexpected and inspiring. And we never really know where we're going to go next with it. But we had Thomas Hawk on our last show, and we all learned something new about Thomas Hawk. And that's hard to do because he's out there.
Yes, you got to learn all about one of his little fetishes.
Yes, and you popped in, and just things happen, you know? You never know. Somebody's going to pop in and say some cool things. But the bottom line is inspiration and learning and just loving the thing that we do. So that's
sure,
Life Through the Lens. It's awesome.
Sure, the one show I didn't get to see all these cool people pop in.
See? I know. We had to have it on a different night, and Keith couldn't be
there. Yeah.
That's why we can't have nice things, Keith.
Yeah, I know. And I do an occasional tech show on Wednesdays at 9 with Dave Veffer quite often, called Tech Plus.
All right. Also, everything is happening. Okay.
It's better than TV. It's like the new TV.
I think the goal is every person on G Plus needs their own show.
Yeah. Seems that way, doesn't it? Okay. Thank you, Tony. And thank you, Dave.
Thank you, guys. Awesome.
Thanks again, everyone, for coming. Thanks, everyone, for watching. And we'll see you next week for a hardcore discussion on Adobe Lightroom. So if you guys have any questions ahead of time, shoot at the Adobe guys. Let me know. I'm all ears. All right. Well, thanks again.
And thanks, everyone. We all
thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you, Trey.